in cash would last us 3 or 4 years. And it did. It kept us going while she kept me in line. It was a good trade, far as she was concerned. She didn't count the money she might have lost, the opportunity cost of stepping away from all that work. She didn't care about the change to our routines. None of that mattered. What mattered, she always said, was that she kept me out of trouble. What counted was that she was there for me, always there. And from that point forward, my mother was always around. She didn't hover like some of the helicopter-type moms you see in some of our more affluent communities. No, sir. Wasn't her style. She didn't walk me to school or demand that I check in with her after my last class, but she was there. She was present. And gotta say, it made all the difference. My mother kept it real, watched over me like a hawk. Her big thing was I had to be home by a certain time each night. I didn't wear a watch, didn't pay attention to the time, no. The Concord was my clock. Check it out. We lived at 103rd Street and Farmers Boulevard, a couple miles from JFK Airport, and you could hear that plane rumble each night as it came in for a landing. My mother used to say, "Damon, as long as you're faster than the Concord, you're okay." So I'd be out playing stickball, chasing girls, hanging on the corner with my friends, whatever. I'd be a couple blocks from home. But as soon as those neighborhood streets started to rumble and rattle with the noise of the Concord, I took off. Oh, man, I ran faster than the Concord because I knew what was waiting for me on the other side of that door if I was late. One other thing, during the summer, when the sun was out longer, I got an extra couple of hours to be outside. And at those times, the Empire State Building was my clock. Every night, the lights at the top of the building would come on when it got dark, and you could see them from all over the city. From my neighborhood, definitely. The cool piece of this story is that my office is now on the 66th floor of the Empire State Building, and every time I ride that elevator, I think back on how things were on the streets of Hollis. Those two clocks, the Concord and the Empire State Building, were such powerful symbols when I was growing up. I always told myself I would fly on a Concord someday, but it stopped flying by the time I started making decent money, so that's not happening. But I do sit pretty close to the top of the Empire State Building, and every night when it gets dark, I imagine little kids all over the city racing home to keep from troubling their mothers. So there was that. Money was tight, though. Let's be honest, it had been tight before, and now it was tighter still. And going over that time in my life, I think it shaped my outlook on money, not having all that much of it. We were up against it constantly. There was a nice enough roof over our heads, nice enough clothes on our backs, but in almost every other way, we were scrambling, scraping. Some months, we'd had to let the electric bill slide to pay for groceries. Winters, we sometimes go without heat for a week or two, but we got by. We were okay, and as soon as I could make some kind of meaningful contribution, I started working my butt off. I guess to try and fill up some of those bank accounts where my mom's paychecks used to go. Tap the power. So here's my takeaway on how I grew up. Adversity on its own isn't necessarily a bad thing. In fact, my whole premise here is that being broke can be like a godsend if you find a way to harness the power of broke and use it to your advantage. What do I mean by that? Well, in my case, it meant finding some piece of motivation in my mother's example to help lift us up and out of our situation. It meant finding inspiration in her perspiration. It meant recognizing that my back was against the wall and the only direction was up and forward. It meant making the most out of whatever resources we had. It meant digging deep and keeping focused and going at it hard. It meant waking up every morning and saying those three little words, rise and grind, over and over, again and again. Think about how you might apply this same mindset to your own life, your own circumstances. Do you have money? That's great. You're off to a running start. Do you need money? That's great, too. You got something to prove. You got to work harder, smarter, faster, longer, just to level the playing field. And if you go at it the right way, somewhere in that harder, smarter, faster, longer, you'll find a kind of competitive edge. You'll separate yourself from the rest of the pack. I'm not suggesting we'd all be better off if we started from nothing, because, hey, money can buy you a whole lot of advantages. Better schools, a financial cushion if things don't go your way, investors you might be able to call on to help you start a business or fund your research, and on and on. But there's a whole lot of silver lining out there for those of us who haven't been lucky enough to be born with silver spoons in our mouths. And for a lot of us, the silver lining covers the whole damn cloud. What it comes down to, I think, is mindset, the poverty of the mind. Are you a have or have not type of person? Are you a want or want not? It's how you approach your situation and what you do to make the best of your situation. That makes all the difference.
Power fact. In 1982, over 60% of the richest Americans on the Forbes 400 list came from wealthy families. 30 years later, only 32% could make the same claim. Inherited wealth is no longer the common denominator among our wealthiest individuals and families. Do the math, people. That means 68% of the wealthiest people started with absolutely nothing. That means today's entrepreneurs have greater opportunities and richer backstories than any other time in our recent history, no matter how they started out in life. That means there's always opportunity, as long as you know where and how to look for it.
There's a great line I heard from Liz Claman, an anchor on the Fox Business Network. She told me once that her father used to say, "I've given you every advantage in life except for being disadvantaged." That cuts right to it, doesn't it? It reminds us that when you grow up on the side of have not, you're used to hearing the word no. In fact, you probably hear it more than any other word in the English language. No, you can't afford this. No, you can't have that. No, that's impossible. When you finally do hear the word yes, you tear off after it. Whatever it is, you're chasing. You've heard no so often, you're numb to it. But yes, it lights you up, fills you with possibilities. On the other side of that, when you grow up privileged, you never hear no. So as soon as those resources are gone, you're in a tough spot. You hear no for the first time, and it's tough to recover. Tough to look for another way to get to yes. Go for it. Okay, so if a willingness to do whatever it takes is fine and good, what happens when whatever it takes is a necessity? What happens when you got no choice but to bust your butt and bring good things to light? On the flip side, what happens to the guts, the swagger, the drive, the hard-charging attitude you need to make it to the top when you know deep down there's a safety net to catch you if you fall? My mother's thing was to think big, always, no matter what. We lived small, but there was no cap on our dreaming, no ceiling on what was possible. So I made it my business to stay out of real trouble and push myself to achieve. Think big. That was like her mantra. She even kept a supersized can opener on the wall of our kitchen, like the kind you used to find in home decorator stores back then. It was up there for inspiration, because in my mother's book, it wasn't enough to hustle to make a couple of extra bucks. You had to hustle, but then you had to do a little something more besides. I had no choice but to be smart about it, to be creative, to think from a place of desperation. And let me tell you, when you're always reaching for that little something more besides, the commitment to finding it, the dead solid certain belief that is there for the taking, it comes to define you. It becomes an important part of your personality. When you come at the world from that place of desperation or aspiration, it's like you're wired in a whole different way. And it was that sense of desperation that would become my fuel. That feeling that I had no option but to succeed. No place to go but up, up, up. That's what powered my first successes. Like a lot of kids in my neighborhood, I was in the snow removal business. Mostly because it didn't take much more than a shovel and some elbow grease to get started. But I went these kids one better because I out-hustled them. See, even at 10, 11 years old, I was out there looking for ways to drum up repeat business. I didn't understand terms like leveraging or upselling, but I guess I understood the concepts because I was putting them to work. I'd go around the neighborhood and offer a free spring cleanup to anyone who'd give me an exclusive contract to shovel their driveway and their front walk for the season. I made deals like that with 6 or 7 people on my block, and then I went out and hired other kids to help me with a lawn mowing business I started up. But not before I told them that if they wanted the job, they'd have to help me on those free spring cleanups I promised those folks during the winter. You know, cleaning out the gutters, tidying up fallen branches and other debris before the start of the season. I didn't understand a term like the power of broke either, but there it was. Here's another way I tapped that power early on. In my neighborhood, it was all about the car. Kids used to hustle, steal, connive, save their way to have enough cash to buy a Jetta or a Sterling or a Cadillac 98. Those were the rides everybody wanted. Used typically, but the car had to look good to mean something. So up and down the street, my boys were stashing their money, hoping against hope they could buy a hot car. Only when my turn came and I saved enough, I went another way. By this time, I graduated from the lawn business and I worked crazy hours at two jobs, at Church's Fried Chicken and at Red Lobster. I walked around smelling like grease from the deep fryer, like melted butter from all those half-eaten lobsters, but the money was decent. The hours? They were crazy, wall to wall. But that was part of the transaction. Managed to make some serious paper, enough to help out around the house, hit the town every now and then, and put a little something away for later. Back of my mind, that little something for later had four wheels and a motor. Clothes were a big deal to me, my kicks especially. They helped to make a statement, announce my arrival. All of that. But as I got older, it was more and more about the car, which I guess came from the same place, wanting to move around the neighborhood in style. Only to buy in was a whole lot steeper. I scrimped and saved, same as everyone else, but I came at it in an entrepreneurial way. I decided to buy a beat-up old van instead of a caddy, one of those 15-passenger vans that wasn't about to turn any heads. Why? Because I saw an opportunity. Don't know that I could have put a name to it just then, but it was the power of broke on full display. It was me putting my money to work because I had no other choice but to double down and look for an edge. And at that age, at that stage, any kind of edge would have done me just fine. For about $12,000 cash, I bought a red and white 15-passenger Ford van, 1979. The van had over 100,000 miles on it, and it had been on the road for over 10 years, but it was in pretty good shape. A little beat up, but reliable. I took a lot of heat from my boys for driving around on such a boring ride, but this was my little something more besides. This was me making an investment in my future. It wasn't enough for my ride to just get me around town. No, for $12,000, my ride had to grow my game, take me to some new opportunities, and here I set it up so I could go into a share-a-ride business. Told myself it'd be like buying a ride and a business. So I set my street cred aside and went for it. Told myself it didn't matter if my ride didn't turn heads. It only mattered that it turned things around for me. Make a plan, tear it up, make a new plan. The way it worked in my neighborhood, there was money to be made shadowing the MTA city buses, providing more of a door-to-door service like a rogue limo driver. These days, ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft are plugging into the same concept in a big way, changing the landscape of the taxi industry. But my take was capped by the technology, the times, and my empty pockets. Still, break it down and you'll see the germ of the same idea. I was out to offer a service you could get elsewhere, but I was out to do it cheaper and more efficiently. Here's how I set things up. I drive along Parsons Boulevard, all the way down to Guy R. Brewer Boulevard, and then to the Rockaways and Beach 116. People would come off and on, and if you hit it right, you can make $40 to $50 in a two-hour round trip. I'll charge a dollar, which was 15 cents cheaper than a city bus, but I stopped wherever you wanted along the route. So that was like the big value-added piece of my service. You know, if you were on one of those main streets, like Merrick Boulevard, it could be 10 or 12 long blocks between stops, which meant people could be 6 or 7 blocks from their apartment. So I'd just pull up right in front of their building. For a lot of women, it was a whole lot safer than riding the bus at night. And when it rained or when it was cold, it was a great way to beat the weather. Riding with me was cheaper, and it was more convenient. And as an added bonus, I also extended credit. I was like one of those mom-and-pop bodega operators in the neighborhood. I came to know my customers, and they came to know me. What's that? You don't have the money today? No problem. You could take care of me tomorrow. So that brought me a whole other mess of customers. Because you needed exact change to ride the city bus, and ain't no way Ralph Cramden was going to let you ride for free.
Power fact. There are over 600,000 new business startups every year in the United States. Now, fewer than half of them, 44% actually, survive 8 years. The message here is that the barriers to entry are coming down in a lot of industries, but success is never guaranteed. Now, the odds aren't exactly in your favor, but they're not against you either. So find a way to get out in front, then find a way to stay out in front.
All these perks added up to the point where folks started looking for me. No, the technology didn't exist yet for me to offer the kind of integrated service customers have come to expect from Uber. But my customers and I did what we can do with the technology that was available at the time, which was basically common sense. My regulars, they knew my schedule, and I knew the best times of the day to get the biggest return on my investment. Obviously, I couldn't just drive up and down the street looking for fares. It cost too much in gas, and there was wear and tear on the van. Expenses I could only justify if I was riding full. Better believe it, I took a lot of grief from my buddies for showing up everywhere in my rundown van, but the girls didn't seem to mind. There was a lot of room in those back seats for us to mess around in, not like those cramped little Jettas, and nobody seemed to mind if I asked them to ride along with me for a while on a busy night. It was never dull, I'll say that. That van became a symbol for me, a reminder that the way forward in business isn't always to spin. Today, I always tell my young entrepreneurs to take affordable next steps. In other words, to think within reach. And this was me practicing what I would go on to preach. Here's how I looked at it. Even if I had the money for a new van, it wouldn't have made a ton of sense to buy one. At $40,000, which was about what a high-end van would have run me back then, leather seats, tinted windows, the works, I would have been behind on the deal. Why? Because the moment I drove it off the lot, the new van would be worth $20,000. Because the used van I bought for $12,000 was still worth about $12,000 after I had been driving it for a year. After I put on 80,000 miles or so, I would probably need a new transmission, maybe a brake job. So let's say that would have run me another $5,000. That still means, all in, I'd be into that used van for $17,000, while the brand new car, after putting 80,000 miles on it, would be inching closer in value to what I paid for the used van in the first place. So you see, the power of broke keeps us from making the easy decisions that come back to bite us. What put me out of business eventually were the tickets. There were gypsy cabs and share ride vehicles all over the city, and few of us had legitimate livery licenses. And pretty soon, the Department of Transportation started cracking down on us. We were taking money from the MTA and from medallion cab drivers, so I could understand that. First time I got a ticket, I just chalked it up to the cost of doing business. But after a while, the tickets started coming in waves. And the fines? They could run me $1,500 a pop, which was a real hit to my pockets. Every here and there, fine, no problem. You find a way to deal. Every month, every other week, that kind of hit punches all kinds of holes in your budget. Affordable next steps. For a time, this van business fit the bill, but it started to hurt, especially after I'd been at it a couple of years and my beat-up ride started needing maintenance. Before I got out of the share-ride game, though, the van proved pretty useful in the launch of my next business. And here again, it was knowing I had to keep scrambling that kept me focused. I could have probably gotten $10,000 for the van at this point, and a lot of guys I know would have jumped at that kind of money. But by this point, I was getting into the clothing business, and the van was turning out to be a real windfall once I started using it to truck all my t-shirts and other gear to black expos up and down the East Coast. A couple of times when I had nothing else on the calendar, I'd even drive to the Apollo Theater, slid open the doors, and started selling t-shirts and tie top hats right out of the van. It was like having a hoopty boutique. Truth was, I couldn't really afford to keep the van once I gave up on the share ride business, but it was a real boost to my new clothing line, so I kept it. And I look back on that decision now as another example of the power of broke on full display. It's not that I wasn't strapped for cash, but I've been strapped for cash my whole life. So I told myself I could ride out this little rough patch and make the most out of my investment in the van while it was still running. I could just roll on up and start slinging clothes. If I had some money behind me, if I could come at it from a place of success, from where I am today, I don't think I would have bumped into this outlet for sales. Not quite in the same way. Don't think I would have been driven in quite the same way. Sorry about that bad pun. Couldn't resist. My head would have been someplace else, and I have probably been looking to make more of a big hit type splash with my clothes. But I didn't have those kind of resources, that kind of mindset. And looking back, I can't shake the belief that this was a good thing. It forced me to grow this ideal I have for a clothing line in a ground up kind of way. Step outside yourself. This right here is the essence of this book. It's all about tapping into the mindset that finds us when we're in that place of hunger, that place of desperation, and putting it to work. It's about embracing the up against it mentality that might have stamped your childhood. The paycheck to paycheck, make every penny count culture that defines so many American households, and putting it to work for you instead of against you. It's also about the kinds of pitfalls that can find you if you get your hands on too much money too soon in the development of your business. I see it all the time on the Shark Tank set, where my fellow panelists and I are regularly pitched by entrepreneurs looking for funding or guidance on a startup or new product launch. Let's be clear. This book is for people of all ages, at all stages of life. Maybe you're just starting out, unsure of where you're going and how to make your mark. You'll find stories to inspire you to follow your own path with just a compass and a flashlight to help you find your way. Or what if you've been working for the man your whole life and are looking to make a change, looking to embrace those entrepreneurial passions before it's too late? You'll also hear from folks just like you. Maybe they've hit some kind of dead end or brick wall and need a harsh wake-up call before doubling back and hitting the restart button. No matter who you are, in almost every situation, at almost every turn, the power of broke can work for you. But it doesn't always work on its own. No, you gotta be willing to try new approaches, adapt to changing technologies, adjust your thinking. Don't believe me that the world is changing? Check out these two stories, one from each end of the age spectrum. The first is about a young guy, looked to be in his early 20s. I met as I was coming out of a hotel in Vegas. We were each waiting for the valets to drive up with our cars, and this kid asked me if I had any advice for him. He recognized me from television, said he was a rapper, trying to catch a break, wanted to know if I could help him out. I said, "That's not really my area of expertise." Just as I was saying that, the valet drove up with this guy's car, a sweet Aston Martin. So I turned to the guy and said, "Homie, it looks like you're doing okay for yourself." It was interesting. The kid was out for advice, but from the looks of things, he was doing better than me. He said, "No, I'm making plenty of money, but it's not what I want to be doing." So I asked him, how was he making his money? And it turned out he was a fairly well-known artist, a painter. He told me he hit upon a great way to monetize his work. Somehow, he'd built a platform of over 100,000 Instagram followers. And each week, he'll put up an original painting and announcing to his followers that the design would be available on a t-shirt for the next 24 hours. It was a one-day and one-day-only type deal. And off that, he would collect all these pre-orders for the limited edition shirt, which he'd price at $40, $50, $75, whatever the case might be. Next day, he'll take his design to the screen printer, run off the precise number of shirts and all the right sizes to fill his order, and ship everything out. Every week, he'd repeat the process with a new design. Right away, I thought, what a great business model. The guy was getting full margin on his orders because he was selling directly to his customer. He didn't have to deal with returns or sizing issues or warehouse issues. There was no overstock, no inventory, no special software, no significant startup cost. And the best part, he set it up so his customers had to prepay, meaning he never had to raise any capital to fill his orders. I said, How much money you making on this deal? He said, last year we did $1.3 million. $1.3 million? On a business run entirely from this guy's cell phone. I couldn't have found a better power of broke story if I hired a Hollywood screenwriter to think something up. And underneath this great success was a reminder that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Why do I say that? Because this guy's business model was basically exactly the same as the one direct mail marketers have been counting on since the 1960s. And so was his conversion rate, 0.5%. He was averaging about 500 t-shirt sales each week off that 100,000 follower base. That's the same return they used to get at Publishing Clearinghouse, at Columbia Record Club, and at pretty much every other direct mail company on the planet. The same return you can still expect. The only difference was that his method of reaching that customer had changed. So even though this kid had found a way to tap into today's technology, he was basically borrowing a page from an old playbook. Same formula, different platform. Second story, and this one's all the way from the other end of the age range. A buddy of mine came to see me one day, told me he was worried about his parents. His father was a master carpenter. His mother was an established efficiency expert. Folks hired her to help them clean out their desk, organize their files and closets. She called herself a declutterer. Things were going great for this guy's parents, who were now in their 60s and looking toward retirement. They did everything right, everything they were supposed to do. They put in their time and kept moving forward in a by-the-book way to the American dream. Then the recession happened. In 2008, the last thing people were thinking about was remodeling or decluttering their homes, so business kind of dried up. Between the two of them, his construction work and her consulting work, their income was down about 80%. And yet, even with that kind of hit, my friend's parents might have been okay. They might have been able to ride out the downturn in the economy, the dip in their revenue, but then the value of their home also took a big hit, and they were underwater. Things got so bad, they had to sell their home at a loss, invade their 401k, and move in with my buddy's grandparents. It was an embarrassing, worrying time. And even if his dad could have signed on as a hired hand with the construction company, it was getting harder and harder for him to climb those ladders and work some of those remodeling jobs. He was getting a little too old for that type of work. Hey, he could fall off a ladder and break his hip, and then where would he be? The solution? Well, it came on the back of a crazy idea. And it came because my friend was able to persuade his father to throw in with him on this idea, before either one of them even knew where it might lead. He went to his dad one day with a set of plans and said, "Build this house." "Why?" the dad asked. "Just do me a favor, Dad, and build this house." He said, "I've got a feeling about this." That's all it was at first, a feeling, a hunch. Turned out there was a market for miniature dog homes, which were popular among super wealthy homeowners looking to set their pets up in style. Makes sense, I guess. If you're spending $4 to $5 million on a house, if you got that kind of money, you wouldn't blink at a $50,000 or $75,000 or $100,000 price tag for a doghouse built to look just like your brand new McMansion. My buddy's father did one of these houses on spec and found that he really liked the work and that he had a talent for it. There were other pluses too. Each house took about a week to design and build. And the best part was that he could do a whole job in a workshop he set up in his basement. No climbing ladders, no slipping and falling, no dealing with bad weather or driving to the job site. And then, since my friend's mom was also underemployed, she used her organizational skills to help with the online marketing. She figured out how to target market pet owners who were also high-end homeowners. Facebook targeting, or geo-targeting as it's called, and this woman became an expert in it before too long. Last year, they sold $2.5 million worth of custom doghouses. Not bad for a couple of old folks, huh? The reason I grouped these two stories together is to make the point that it doesn't matter if you're a digital native, like the young artists with the limited edition t-shirts, or digital immigrants, like the older couple who kind of stumbled onto the doggy real estate business, the power of broke can be a real force for change. You don't need a whole lot of resources to change your life. Sometimes everything you need is right there in the smartphone you hold in your hands. Gotta love technology, right? Be resourceful. Find beauty in chaos. Steve Aoki, musician, DJ, record producer, music executive. Sometimes you come into this world surrounded by success and opportunity, but that doesn't mean you'll have it easy. Doesn't mean you won't have to scratch for it, sweat for it, bleed for it, same as everyone else. In some cases, you can even make the case that you'll have to scratch a little harder, sweat a little more, bleed another couple buckets just to prove yourself. Why? Because you might find yourself going against what's expected of you. Because folks might think the good life's been handed to you. Because you have to pick up the pace to step out from your family's shadow. That's how it was for Steve Aoki, the electro house DJ who's probably done more to define the techno music scene than any other artist. Electronic dance music. He's made it his brand. He's reshaped, redefined, restamped the genre. All of that. To watch him do his thing in front of audiences of 30,000 screaming, sweating, slamming fans, dousing the crowd with blasts of champagne and cakes and pies, whipping an entire arena into a joyful frenzy, is to take an innovative artist at the very top of his game. Oh man, it's a thrilling thing to watch this guy work the crowd. But underneath all of that is a whole other thrill. He's an entrepreneur who's tapped the heart of a movement in a fundamental way and changed the face of mainstream music. And it's something to see, something to celebrate. What a lot of people don't know is that Steve stepped into this spot from an unlikely place. He grew up in Newport Beach, California, the son of Rocky Aoki, another entrepreneur who changed the landscape. He was the founder of the ridiculously successful Benihana restaurant chain. What this meant for Steve growing up was that he came from a place of privilege. He played badminton on his high school team. He went to college, the University of California at Santa Barbara. Back of everyone's mind, it was generally assumed he'd go into the family business and find a way to build on his father's great success. Back of everyone's mind, that is, except for Steve Aoki's. Back of his mind, there was something else at play. By the time Steve was born, his father was already kind of a hip-hop star in his own world. Rocky Aoki went to nightclubs, partied hard, drove fancy-ass cars. He was always making the papers, but not always in a good way. You have to realize, this was a guy who'd scrape and hustle to the top, came over to the States from Japan to make his way. He actually came here on a tour to wrestle for the Japanese national team, ended up staying. Wound up driving an ice cream truck because there weren't a whole lot of opportunities for young Japanese men at the time. Not so soon after World War II, anyway. Think about that. Guy busts his butt wrestling for his country, even earns a spot on the 1960 Olympic team, travels to America on a national dime to represent his country, and the only work he could find is slinging toasted almonds and fudge bars from a truck.
Power fact. In the United States, immigrants are twice as more likely to start a business than a U.S. citizen. There's a reason for this. When you're new to the American shore, you're hungry for success. If you've been here your whole life, there's less on the line. It doesn't mean that you're not hungry, but it's a whole different appetite. When you're trying to make your way in a new place, it has more to do with survival and less to do with getting by.
Know your place. Steve felt a different kind of discrimination growing up in the suburbs of California, where there still weren't a whole lot of opportunities for a young Japanese kid. During high school, early 1990s, he remembers feeling like he was always on the outside looking in, somehow different or other than everyone else. He was never sure if it was because everyone knew who his father was, knew he had money, or it was just because he was Japanese. Whatever it was, he stood out, and he fell in with a group of other marginalized kids and decided to just do his own thing. And how it worked out, he found his own thing by embracing a hardcore punk lifestyle. People with money, there are basically two ways they raise their children, Steve says now, looking back on his father's influence. They either take the attitude, I had to work hard for what I have, and I want you to follow the same discipline, so I'm not going to give you anything. You know, nothing was handed to me, so nothing is handed to you. That kind of thinking. Or it's more like, I worked hard so you don't have to go through what I had to go through. And those are the kids who grow up with the best of everything. The best education, the best opportunities, a leg up in business, whatever. To hear Steve tell it, his father never missed an opportunity to tell Steve and his two older siblings how hard he worked to get where he was. But that wasn't what left Steve thinking he was on his own. No, that part came from the punk community he decided to embrace. In that world, Steve says, it's all about what you bring to it on your own. It's all about making things happen. Kids with money, kids with influence, that doesn't cut it. To make it work, it's got to be genuine. You have to make your own way. So he did. Tried to, anyway. And at first, it was rough going. Now, it's also worked out that Steve's father fell into the category of rich, accomplished dads who expected their kids to go it alone. So even if Steve had put his hand out, it would have come back empty. It was just as well, he says. Creative types on the punk scene at the time, making music, organizing events, writing fanzines, were all about bootstrapping. They dug deep, worked hard, found a way to get things done, on the cheap, on the fly. To go to your rich father with your hand out, that wasn't the way of that world. Wasn't Steve's way either. He wanted to cut his own path and on his terms, just like his father. So Steve and his crew grabbed what they could. Long story short, Steve ended up starting his own record label when he was just 19 years old. Dim Mac Records. Started it with two other friends, each putting in $400, which was pretty much all they had. Remember, this was a time in the music industry when you could put out a 7-inch single and hope to make some noise with it. Only the noise Steve and his buddies made with Dim Mac early on was little more than a whisper. It was all about the idea, he tells me. It was finding a way to get it done. Going to Kinko's, stealing a bunch of copies to get the word out, heading out to shows and selling our 7-inch from the trunk of our car, making about 75 cents for every record we sold. Banking that money until we had enough to put out another. And then, soon as we could, we started putting on our own shows. In my apartment, at the 80-person capacity bar down the street, wherever. Same deal as with our records. If we made money on one party, we'd put it right into the next one. Steve's mindset was a whole lot like mine starting out. He did what he had to do to keep his place at the party. But it was all about the party, man. He believed in this music, same way me and my boys believed in our t-shirts and hats. Steve kept putting it out there and putting it out there. And he counted it a success that he was making enough to be able to keep at it, even if he and his friends weren't putting much money in the bank. Make a beautiful mess. The thing with Steve and his friends at the front end of Dim Mac, they weren't thinking about building a business. Their reality was they couldn't afford to think about building a business. All they can do, really, was scrape and hustle and work like crazy in service of their idea, to put their music out into the world, somehow, some way. The bottom line for them was all about keeping it real, keeping it simple, and most of all, keeping it going. Wasn't a business plan so much as it was a desperation plan, a survival plan. Put out one record and hope like hell you get to put out another, and another. It was a model Steve believed he had no choice but to make work. And with a whole lot of creativity and extra effort, Dim Mac kept going. At some point, Steve started DJing. Small gigs at first, sometimes for the exposure, and sometimes for a couple $100. A lot of times, he'd set up these gigs himself, at local bars and party spaces. It wasn't until Steve signed the British indie band Block Party that Dim Mac started to look like it could turn into a real business. But even this success came in a kind of hand-to-hand way. Steve had to max out 10 different credit cards just to get the record out. He was over $90,000 in debt, with no idea how to pay it off. He'd moved to New York and started running the entire operation out of his 900-square-foot apartment, which doubled as his office. Oh, and he shared the space with his girlfriend and 13 interns. So it was a little like living and working in a phone booth. Things were crazy tight, crazy basic, just crazy. We couldn't afford to hire anyone, so those interns were key, he tells me. And it was a great experience for them, it was, but I had no idea what some of them were doing. I was like, could you cook something? I mean, I didn't know what to do with some of these kids who came to work for us from all over the world. They believed in what we were doing, wanted to be a part of it, sacrificed a lot, some of them, just to throw in with us. We were kind of a big deal, I guess, but we were a big deal with no money. We were a big deal on paper, in theory. There were records piled everywhere. People were staking out their little pieces of territory. But there was excitement, too. Incredible excitement and energy. It was really kind of a beautiful mess. I love thinking back on that time in that little apartment. I was broke out of my mind. And the whole time, it would have been nothing for me to reach out to my father and say, hey, can you help me out? But he would have just told me to run away from what I was doing. He didn't believe in it. He didn't believe in me. Plus, he didn't understand the music business. Not that I understood it either, but I felt it, you know? I believe in it. My father, he wanted me to get a real job. Not at Benihana's, that was his thing. But he would have introduced me to people he knew in business so I could learn my stuff somewhere else. Catch the wave. Steve remembers that those little $100 and $200 DJ gigs really made the difference, kept him going. He was trading on good faith and goodwill just to arrange for all these up-and-coming bands to play at these parties he was putting together. Parties where he could sell his Dim Mac records and swag. Parties where he could maybe talk himself into his next DJ gig. He barely had time to worry about things like rent and food and utilities. From the sound of things, he worried more about momentum than money. When things were slow, he threw together another party, put out another record, and over time, Dim Mac became the hipster stamp of approval that spoke to this whole community. Without really realizing it, without really meaning to, Steve had built a kind of movement, a following, and with it, he developed a reputation. People came to appreciate that if it was a Dim Mac event, if it was a Steve Aoki event, it would be at a certain level, a certain quality. And if it had been a long time between events, a long time between records, there'd be another one coming along soon enough. He still wasn't making any money, but he looked up one day and realized he had built this pulsing, thrumming business, all on the back of his sweat and hustle. It was the power of broke, man. Don't think it could have happened any other way. Steve doesn't think so either. When I asked him how things would have gone if his father had given him $100,000 early on to bankroll his business, Steve smiles, shrugs his shoulders. He says, I would have squandered it, spent it all on the wrong things for all the wrong reasons. No way I could have built the same energy, the same movement. No way the community would have taken me seriously. You have to want it, but it cuts deeper than that. You have to need it, like a hunger, you know? Yeah, I know, but it takes an enormous amount of inner strength to see it through. It takes knowing that things will shake out to good in the end, because you left yourself no other option but to succeed. You have to eat it, Steve says. In the end, that's what it comes down to. You have to get knocked off the horse a couple of times and roll around in the dirt, take your lumps, whatever. And then you got to find a way to get back on your feet, back on that horse, and go at it again. That beautiful mess Steve was talking about when he was ramping up his business from his cramped apartment with more interns than he knew what to do with, that's the kind of chaos a true entrepreneur needs to survive and thrive, to put his ideas out into the world with the full force of his conviction. Absolutely, you need to max out your credit cards a time or two. You need to go to bed not knowing how you'll keep the lights on tomorrow. You need to bet on yourself, and you need to bet big, almost in an all-or-nothing sort of way. You need to be resourceful. You need to catch the wave. That's how it was with me and my partners when we were jump-starting FUBU. We emptied our pockets to get it done. I borrowed $100,000 against my mother's house to buy a bunch of sewing machines and enough material to fill our first bunch of orders. That left me with just enough to hire a half a dozen people to sew for us, and a bare-bones operation that had just enough fuel to keep going, but only for a time. So let's be clear on this. Steve Aoki may have had a little bit more of a safety net than yours truly. He grew up with money. He grew up with opportunities. But it was his father's money, not his. His father's opportunities, not his. His father's safety net, too. Far as Steve was concerned, he started from scratch. He was up against it from day one. And it was because he was up against it that he found a way to succeed. His music, his message, it all came from a genuine place. It wasn't a business venture so much as a business adventure. And I have to think the thrill of not knowing what would happen next, not knowing where his next meal was coming from, his next gig, that all of that not knowing added up to a kind of dead solid certainty that he was on the right path.
Steve's key shark point, set a goal. For Steve, finding a goal meant finding a way to make the music he wanted to hear. That's where it all started for him. The objective each time out was to get to the next time out, meaning one project needed to make just enough money to fund the next project. Even when he maxed out all his credit cards, Steve just wanted to keep the lights on, to keep it going. It wasn't until he actually staged a couple of events that he thought about launching his own record label. And it wasn't until that happened that he was able to start thinking about actually paying off those credit cards and making some real paper. The great lesson here is that your goals don't have to be life-changing to get to where you want to go. Just kind of like life-sustaining. Keep the lights on and good things will happen. Steve was taking affordable next steps and moving himself closer and closer to where he needed to be. What affordable next steps are you able to start taking today to get closer to your goals?
Be yourself. Honor your truth. Acacia Brindley, social media icon, face of a generation, selfie queen. Broke is a great equalizer. It levels the playing field, gives the edge to hustle and heart over money and market forces. Best of all, it forces you to dig deep, to invest in yourself and trust in yourself, and maybe to kick yourself in the butt enough times that the full force of your personality has a chance to shine through. That's how it shook out when we were launching our FUBU clothing line, trying to make some noise at our first trade show in Vegas, competing for orders and shelf space with top designers from all over the world. To a lot of folks, it must have looked like a no-win situation for street smart kids from Hollis, Queens, with no business being in business. But to us, it was more of a can't-lose situation. Why? Because we were already up against it. Because we had no choice but to succeed. We would not be denied, and I think it came across, how much our designs meant to us and what we thought they could mean to our community. Plus, we had a secret weapon. We tapped into a disruptive technology that didn't cost us a cent. The same technology that was available to every other designer on the floor of the Las Vegas Convention Center, only they didn't recognize it for what it was. So here's the thing. When it comes to disruptive technology, there's always something new. For us, it was the reach and power of hip-hop, magnified by the reach and power of music videos and underlined by the unshakable belief that we were onto something. What's that you say, Damon? Hip-hop? A technology? Disruptive? Well, yeah, kinda, sorta. Stay with me on this and you'll see what I mean. Music has always been a unifying force, a change agent set to a beat. It's how we talk to each other about our hopes and fears, our wildest dreams, our darkest secrets. It's how we hear about trends and movements. It's how we speak out. In the 60s, it was all about peace and love and war. Remember? Not me, I'm too young, but I know my history. Back then, protest music ruled the airwaves. People were against the war in Vietnam, against the establishment, against the machine. And these sentiments came out in the music of the day. Jump ahead a bunch of years and you can hear the same tune set to a different beat. In my neighborhood, in my time, hip-hop was that driving force. It was just a bunch of street kids like me talking to each other. And absolutely, a lot of what we talked about was rage and damn the police nonsense. But a lot of it was about who we were and what we were about. Hey man, I like this shirt. Hey, this is what I do. This is the way I walk. This is the way I talk. This is what I stand for. The disruptive technology I just mentioned, it was the marriage of hip-hop and music videos, because that's how we were able to get our shirts on the backs of all of these up-and-coming hip-hop artists and make some noise. Getting someone like LL Cool J to wear our gear was like a multi-million dollar ad campaign for us, and it all came about in an organic way. Be the change. Jump ahead another bunch of years and you'll find a new disruptive technology, social media. For a young girl named Acacia Brinley, growing up in Orange County, California, sites like Tumblr loomed as a great escape. Social media spoke to her the same way hip-hop spoke to me. She didn't look at these sites as tools to grow her brand or build a business. No. For Acacia, they were a place to hide, maybe reinvent herself. And maybe, just maybe, they were a place where she could be herself. I was bullied in school, she shares when we sit down to discuss her unlikely rise to becoming one of the top influencers on social media today, with over 4 million followers across all platforms. All the other girls were wearing Uggs, Abercrombie, Juicy Couture, whatever was new, whatever was hot. And there was me with my fake Uggs from Forever 21, or my jeans from Old Navy, whatever was on sale. I didn't have the right clothes, so the girls didn't like me. And then, of course, the guys didn't like me because they followed what the girls were doing. Basically, I didn't have any friends. I didn't play sports, didn't play music, didn't participate in any extracurricular activities at school. So it's like I didn't even exist.
Power fact. 89% of 18 to 29-year-olds use social media. Now, what does that tell us? Well, if you're a kid like Acacia looking for a way to connect with other folks the same age, with the same interests and the same passions, the first place you should look is in your smartphone. It's right in your hands. And since 50% of the people on this planet are now under 30 years old, social media is the best, most efficient way to reach this market, no matter what you're selling.
Okay, so just as being broke can be a great equalizer, feeling broken can be a great motivator. When you're down on yourself, when you're feeling boxed in, when your life isn't exactly firing on all cylinders, that's when a lot of innovators reach for that little extra something and just go for it. Like me and my FUBU partners, they get in their head that they won't be denied. They kick things up a notch and find a way to shine through. That's basically what happened with Acacia. It'd be easy for me to suggest that she went out and reinvented herself on social media, where she's now known as the selfie queen. No, she didn't come up with the practice of snapping and posting pictures of herself online, but she damn near perfected it. Just don't tell my friend Kim Kardashian that I'm giving Acacia the title here. Truth be told, Acacia didn't reinvent herself so much as she rediscovered herself at a time in her life when she didn't have a whole lot going on and her self-esteem was way down low. Alone in her room, alone with her thoughts, she turned to Tumblr, the blogging site developed by David Karp that had quickly become a safe haven and a creative outlet for millions of young, introspective writers, thinkers, artists, lost souls, and outcasts from all over the world. I was 12, maybe 13, she remembers, and I made a Tumblr account just for fun. I wasn't trying to do anything, say anything, become anything big. It was just something to do, a way to express myself, maybe find some other kids out there just like me. I had no friends in real life, and I just thought, you know, maybe I could make some friends online. Soon enough, sure enough, she did. Only they weren't friends in the traditional sense. Still, when there's no way to fit yourself in at school, no one to talk to, a follower can be a tremendous validation. And Acacia found herself cherishing this new community, a place where nobody judged her, where she was accepted for who she was, and it felt to her like home. Stay true. Now, I got a confession to make. I'm a fan of pop culture. I try to keep in touch with what's going on in the world, what's going on in my world anyway. It's what I do, how I'm wired, where I find my edge. And for years now, Acacia Brinley has been an important influencer, a person to watch if you want to stay on top of the trends. Does that sound crazy? Me, a 40-something adult-type male following the online doings of a California teenager? Well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. But those of us who work in fashion, in television, in music, in lifestyle businesses, we've got young people like Acacia on our radar because they're the powerful change agents of our times. And Acacia's right up there with the best of them. Without even meaning to, without even trying, she's built a meaningful network of sponsors like Drop Dead UK, Brandy Melville, One Piece, and Nasty Gal, who pay Acacia some serious paper just to endorse their product and programs in her own genuine way. Even the folks at Pepsi, McDonald's, and the Olympics have reached out to her for a marketing assist. That's how plugged in she is to the pulse of her generation. As soon as I hit on the concept for this book, I knew I had to reach out to this young woman and learn how she got where she is. And I'm glad I did, because in Acacia's story, I saw elements of my own. At some point early on, Acacia started noticing a couple of people posting pictures of themselves, pictures they'd clearly taken themselves. No one was using the term selfie back then, but these mirror-type pictures we take of ourselves were starting to become popular. Acacia thought she could improve on the trend, maybe give it her own spin. Her father was a photographer, and he let her borrow one of his old cameras, which of course did a much better job of capturing sharp images than the primitive cell phone cameras of the day. So she got in the habit of posting a picture of herself online almost every single day. It became her routine, her thing. And on the back of that thing, people started to pay attention. Folks on Tumblr started blogging and reblogging about Acacia's pics. She developed a following in the hundreds at first, but then she kept on adding zeros to the total and getting other social media platforms like Twitter and Instagram into the mix. And one day, she looked up and she was a regular damn phenomenon. It felt so good getting all this attention, she says now. I started to think all those kids at school didn't know what they were talking about because these kids on the internet thought I was cool. They thought I was cute. I was getting all of this great feedback, all these great comments. This went on for a while, and Acacia was feeling the love, feeling good about herself for the first time in a long time. But eventually, the tide started to turn. It happens to everyone on social media. You reach a kind of critical mass, a tipping point, and all of a sudden, folks start hating on you, you know, just because they can. It's the way of the internet, right? Only when you're 13 years old, you're not exactly equipped to deal with such mass rejection, such random cruelty. Acacia remembers feeling blindsided by the negative attention that started coming her way. At the time, my blog had nothing to do with my personality, she tells me. It wasn't like it is today, so at first I was able to protect myself a little bit. I could tell myself these people didn't know me, couldn't hurt me, whatever. But at the same time, there was an important lesson in there. Even as a little kid, I could see that these people were bullying me just based on my appearance. It was just like in school. People started calling me a slut, a whore, just these awful, awful things. And it's not like I was posting all these provocative pictures or anything. I was just a kid posting these simple pictures of me and my flannels, me and my bulky sweaters, me and my braces. But even at 13, 14 years old, I knew they were just taking me down to feel better about themselves. Pretty smart for a kid, don't you think? I had my share of haters back in the day. Remember, when I started out, designers were mostly white and gay. That was the stereotype back then, and I cut against it. I wasn't one of those flamboyant designer types. The crowd in my neighborhood was a little more street, a little rough around the edges. They didn't know what to make of me sewing my own hats, designing my own shirts. I took a lot of heat for it, but if someone stepped to me on this, I usually stepped back. I gave as good as I got. It was the way of the street. So what did Acacia do when she found herself in her version of the same spot? Nothing. Amazingly, tellingly, she ignored the haters and kept on doing her thing. She knew that if she took the bait and responded to all the negative comments, she'd come off looking just as bad as the haters. So she took the high road. I listened to Acacia share this part of the story and I'm blown away because what she had to deal with was way bigger than anything I had to face. This was cruelty on a grand scale. With me, the hassle was face to face, one on one. With Acacia, there were hundreds of people at a time, maybe even thousands, just slinging all this mean nonsense her way. But she didn't react to it. She didn't shrink from it. Actually, she grew from it. Haters like that, I call them cheerleaders with dirty pom-poms, because the worst thing in the social media space is when people aren't talking about you at all. If they're talking about you, it means you've gotten to them in some way. And Acacia found a certain strength in that, a certain power. I started to see the power in just being me, she explains. I'd always been this relatable, regular teenage girl. I didn't have any money. I didn't wear Coach. I had my own style. But with me, it wasn't about the designer labels. It was about a certain lipstick color I liked. Or maybe a certain shoe or accessory. It was about